these life changes. No doubt, the death of a loved one is devastating, and the grieving process varies from person to person. All death-related business matters are handled personally by a member of the Martin family, either Ross or his son Tom Martin. For personal preference at a funeral home, let the Martin Funeral Home handle everything. The Martin Funeral Home, located on Center Avenue in Butler.
Well, it looks like we do have that rain, some snow coming our way as we work through our afternoon. And our afternoon will go up to a high of about 47. We're just a couple of degrees away from that. Then the highs this afternoon will fall to about 38. But then we'll get a low tonight down to 28 degrees. And we'll still have a 50-50 shot tonight of that wintry mix coming our way between rain and snow. And then tomorrow, a chance of snow showers in the morning with a high of 31, a low down to just about 24. And then on Wednesday, a 40% chance of some snow showers, cloudy on Wednesday, and a high near 30 degrees. We currently have 45 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Your news time is just about 12:30. Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us and have a good day.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.
It's a book talk day here on It's Your Turn today. My name is Dave Malarkey. Book talk is one of our more popular features. We've been doing it for many, many years in cooperation with the library system of Butler County. Various public libraries around the county take turns selecting a book. And once a month, we talk about it. And this month, it's the turn of the Mars Area Public Library. And with us here to discuss what I think is a pretty good book, Cheryl Ferrero, who's on staff at Mars. Cheryl, good to see you.
Thanks for having me again, Dave.
You know, I forgot to check the last time we chatted, but it seems like it was quite a while back.
I think it was at least 6 months, maybe longer.
I think maybe even longer.
Might have been last year.
Well, good to see you again.
Nice to be back.
The book we're discussing on Book Talk this month is called Lincoln's Last Trial. Subtitle, The Murder Case That Propelled Him to the Presidency, and the author is Dan Abrams. Our listeners may recognize that name from TV, right?
Right. He's a regular legal correspondent for ABC. I watched him on Good Morning America, I think sometimes on ABC News, and you mentioned.
Yeah, he's on this show on, I believe it's on the A&E Network. And it's on the weekends, I know, Friday and Saturday night. It's called Live PD.
I haven't heard of it.
And they have, of course, most police officers now have video cameras. They have from various points in the country, Rhode Island, New Mexico, Texas, Florida. They have, you know, they follow police out on their calls on Friday and Saturday night. It's pretty interesting. But I didn't know that he was still doing the legal work for ABC as well.
I saw him a little while ago. I can't really remember the last time. But, yeah, he's often in debates with Nancy Grace on some case that's prominent in the news.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know him anyway.
We do.
And this is not his first book. I was surprised. He's written some other ones, too.
I was unaware of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is it's a history book, Lincoln's Last Trial. And I got to tell you, I really enjoy this. In fact, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to when I first picked it up, because I'm not a real Civil War buff. This is not about the Civil War, but I'm not a real Lincoln buff. I mean, I certainly admire Abraham Lincoln, but I've not, you know, read a lot of biographies or anything about him. I just don't read too many biographies. You?
I have not. I've read more excerpts of things that Lincoln wrote or said throughout history, and of course studying the Civil War, he's so prominent. But I was not familiar with his lawyer history. I mean, other than I knew he was a lawyer, but this really delves into some of his cases, not just the one that's highlighted in the book, which I found fascinating, and some of the precedent he set winning some of those cases. And it kind of went in what you think his character is, how they describe, how Dan Abrams describes him is pretty much what we all know of Lincoln, but to hear it in the courtroom was kind of neat.
Historians, in most cases, tend to gloss over Lincoln the attorney, but he was a practicing attorney for 20 years, before he became president. So that was a significant part of his life, and he was well known in Illinois.
Very well known.
As an attorney, he practiced mainly in Springfield, which was the state capital. In fact, he was instrumental in having the capital moved to Springfield. But that's where he practiced law. And he made a couple of runs for office while he was still practicing. He had the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates while he was still practicing law. But he was already thinking about a run for the White House, and that came shortly after the trial that is discussed at some length in this book, Lincoln's Last Trial. Now, I will say this. I like this book a great deal with a couple of reservations.
Let me guess.
Well, first of all, although the facts are meticulously set down, and we'll tell the folks why that is the case in a moment or so here, but Abrams kind of insists on imagining some of what Lincoln would have said or imagining Lincoln's thoughts.
I knew that was going to be your crux. I knew it.
Well, and he did that to make it interesting, and
right.
It did make it fascinating, but, you know, who can imagine for sure what Lincoln actually, what his actual words were, what his thoughts were, for goodness sakes, 150 years ago?
Right. This seems to be a popular trend now. I know we read, was it George Washington's Secret Six?
Mm-hmm.
There's been a couple of nonfiction history books that are, and in the beginning they acknowledge that they are taking the liberty to fill in what they think might be some conversations, and I think it reads more like a novel, which I think people enjoy, so they're probably selling more books. But it is the difference between reading a David McCullough biography and reading, you know, a book like this.
Excellent analogy, yeah. And it makes it popular, and it makes it more of a page-turner, but okay, I'm not a person who thinks plain old history is boring.
Right.
You don't have to conjure up Lincoln's exact words or his thoughts for me. I could have enjoyed this story otherwise.
And I think he had enough factual things of what things were being said to not even need that. I found that did bog the book down, the extra conversational. I feel it was in there, and it didn't even always flow naturally because there was so many actual facts that were interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And the other reservation that I had, and again, this did not ruin the book for me by any means. I really enjoyed this book, but it's the subtitle, Lincoln's Last Trial, the murder case that propelled him to the presidency. In fact, it wasn't his last trial.
Correct.
He had several minor ones in the year or so after this trial. It was his last sensational trial, his last murder trial. I don't know why they put this subtitle in, the murder case that propelled him to the presidency. They make no case for that throughout the book.
No.
There's no evidence that it propelled him to the presidency. If it had gone poorly, it might have precluded him being elected president, but oh well.
Which they kind of give it away, because as I was reading it, I said to my daughter, I sure hope he wins this case since it's what propelled him. But I guess the infamy of it might have propelled him anyway. But, yeah, it kind of gave it away.
So how do we know so much? I mean, after all, this is 150 years ago. This murder trial took place in 1859, summer of 1859. How do we know so much about the testimony? Well, that is thanks to a man named Robert Roberts Hitt, H-I-T-T, Hitt,
right.
who was one of the first court stenographers.
Yes.
I had never heard of him before. Had you?
No, I had not. But he really made a name for himself.
He did.
With his meticulous note-taking.
Now, obviously, we didn't have any tape recorders or video recorders back in those days, for sure. But I just assumed that the court stenographers, which we still have, by the way.
Right.
Which kind of amazes me, actually, with all the capabilities we have for electronic recording. Why do we still have somebody trying to take it down in shorthand? But that was relatively new at this time, just prior to the Civil War. There were others, but this Robert Hitt guy, he was the premier court stenographer mm-hmm. of the day, and actually developed a system to be able to take down testimony very quickly, kind of his own personal shorthand.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And then he transcribed it, and he was very good at his job.
Excellent, yeah. Yes. He was actually hired by a newspaper in Chicago. I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head. But the year before this murder trial took place was the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Abraham Lincoln debating Stephen Douglas. And it was known that these were going to be pretty interesting. And Robert Hitt was hired to transcribe the debates, which he did. And he sent them by telegraph back to Chicago, and then they went throughout the country to newspapers, and that's how people knew so much about these debates. And it's really how Abe Lincoln first became a national figure.
Right.
So when this trial was about to take place, the newspaper in Chicago once again sent Robert Hitt down to Springfield, 9 hours by train,
yes.
Incidentally. Must have been a mighty slow train, huh?
I guess. That doesn't seem like it's that far geographically.
No. I mean, Springfield obviously south of Chicago. Chicago's up on Lake Michigan.
But, right.
Well, anyway, took 9 hours. But he was sent down there by the newspaper to transcribe the testimony in this trial. They did not have a court stenographer. The attorneys relied on their own memory.
Right.
The judge relied on his memory, and the jury, and so on and so forth. So Lincoln knew this guy.
Yes.
From the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that they were chummy, but he knew him, and he certainly recognized his skill. And in fact, Lincoln contracted with him. He wanted a copy of this.
Right.
You know, and I think it said he paid $27.50 for a complete transcript of the trial, which lasted for 4 days, by
right,
the way.
Right. So he got his money's worth.
And this trial did indeed get national attention. When Hitt would finish transcribing for the day, he would send it by telegraph to newspapers throughout the country, including Horace Greeley's New York Tribune, which was the biggest newspaper of the day.
That's why I had Tribune written down. I was like, it wasn't Chicago. But
yeah, I knew that one was in New York.
Yeah.
But anyway, Abe Lincoln became pretty famous because of this, and he was obviously thinking about a run for the White House already. That would come a year later. Now, the other amazing thing about this transcript, okay, it was meticulous. It was extremely accurate. But it disappeared after the trial was over, and it was discovered. Was it
1989.
It was found in a shoebox in a garage
in Fresno, California.
Not even in Illinois.
Tied with a ribbon.
And it was in the garage of the great grandson of the defendant, the man who was accused of murder in this case. So that's what sparked Dan Abrams to write this book.
Yes.
Because he had such a definitive record of the trial. Okay, if you're joining us a little bit late, welcome. Great to have you with us here on It's Your Turn today. It's a book talk day, and we're talking with Cheryl Ferrero from Mars Area Public Library. She's on staff there. The book that we're discussing is Lincoln's Last Trial, by Dan Abrams. New book, by the way, published earlier this year.
It is new, yes.
Did you select this yourself, or was it a book club choice down at the Mars Library? Or what?
Actually, I did select it. There were a couple of patrons that had come in when I was starting to think about what book to pick, and they were saying they really enjoyed it. So I thought, oh, I'm going to read that.
Well, I know from past years, gosh, someday I'm going to have to look up how many books you and I have talked about over the years. It's many. But there are a lot of Civil War buffs and Abe Lincoln buffs here in our listening area. And so they'll be particularly interested in this book, although I think anybody would be. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. So let's get to the principals in the murder trial. Well, there were two hot-headed young men.
Right.
And there was a family feud that had developed. And, of course, there was a case of honor and so on and so forth. And one guy who thought he'd been aggrieved said he was going to get a bunch of other guys and beat the snot out of this other guy. And the other guy got worried and armed himself with a knife. And sure enough, they came after him and in a drugstore of all places.
Right.
And he was reading the newspaper. They pulled him away and they started beating him up. And they were going to take him out back and pound his face in. He pulled out his knife, slashed the other guy in the abdomen.
Yes.
And he died 3 days later. And thus we have the murder trial. The guy who did the slashing, the defendant, was...
Peachy.
You can't make up these names,
no.
Folks. His name was Quinn Harrison, or known as Peachy. Peachy Harrison.
Peachy Harrison.
Who was just 24 years old at the time, by the way. And the other guy,
right,
was killed, was mortally wounded and eventually died, was also a young man. Again, you can't make up these names. His name was Greek Crofton.
Correct.
Greek, like, you know, from Greece. I don't know where these names come from. Peachy and Greek. Now, there's a lot of... I mean, it's an interesting story already. But there's a lot of other interesting stuff here. Peachy's father, Peachy's the guy that
was
on trial for murder, yeah,
right.
Peachy Harrison. His father, Peyton Harrison, was a staunch Republican and a longtime friend of Abe Lincoln and a Lincoln supporter.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. But he also had connections. I mean, everybody knew Lincoln, so
yeah.
He seemed to have connections with both sides.
The guy who was mortally wounded and died 3 days later had aspired to the law. He wanted to become a lawyer, and he had trained as a clerk in Lincoln's office,
right,
for goodness sakes.
Right.
In Lincoln's own office.
I was amazed, as a sidebar, at how, no pun intended, sidebar, at how the people became lawyers at that time.
Hmm.
I really thought there was more of a formal education, but you really kind of just studied with a lawyer. You read some books, Black's Law books at least, that I was familiar with, but I thought it was definitely a more formal process even then.
It's a great point. I knew that Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer. He never went to law school.
Right. Well, I don't think there was a law school at the time.
In fact, Abe Lincoln tried a lot of different professions. I wrote that down somewhere in my notes, and I've got several pages of notes.
Yes,
here.
Yes, me
so
too.
He was a shopkeeper. He worked on a riverboat as a deckhand. He was a captain of a riverboat. He was a surveyor. All of this stuff in his young life, and then he decided, I think I might want to practice law. Started reading books. Trained with another lawyer, and that was it. All that you needed to get a license to practice law in Illinois was a certificate from a judge that said you were of good moral character.
Right.
That was it.
I mean,
you could become a lawyer, and that's how Abe Lincoln became a lawyer.
I totally missed that in studying history. Yeah, so that was interesting to me.
Never heard that before.
No.
And that's the way that this the victim in this murder was thinking about becoming a lawyer and was studying in Lincoln's office.
The other thing I thought was odd, unless I missed it, did they actually ever say specifically what the grievance was between the two men?
Well, that gets complex, too, and I got to be honest with you. I actually wrote that down trying to figure it out, and one of them was married to the sister of the other one. No, wait a minute.
The brother?
Greek's brother was married to the sister of Peachy.
Right.
And there was allegations of abuse there, and that's what started it all.
So that's what I wrote down, and then I was like, but wouldn't that mean that Peachy should be mad at Greek? But was it that he was saying disparaging things about Greek's brother, so then Greek needed to defend his brother's honor? Because really, if she was the one being abused, that was Peachy's sister. So that confused me.
Back in the day. And you know, we talk about violence today, and obviously we decry that, but it was just as rampant back then. They didn't have assault rifles, but I didn't know until I read this book that Abraham Lincoln had been challenged to a duel.
Yes, that was another interesting side story.
Because of some personal affront.
Yes.
And he graciously got out of it. He declined. he was ready to take part in a duel. Abe Lincoln, for goodness sake. Honest
right.
Abe.
It just seemed common, yes.
Let's take a break. We'll be back and talk more about what is, to me, really a fascinating book, Lincoln's Last Trial by Dan Abrams. And we'll pick up our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a moment.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
On average, humans walk 100,000 miles during the course of their lives, so it makes sense our feet and ankles may suffer wear and tear. Doctors William Saar and Christopher Edwards of the foot and ankle team at Tri Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers diagnose and treat numerous injuries and conditions to help get you back on your feet. Their approach to orthopedic foot and ankle care offers a wide range of conservative to surgical treatment options. To learn more, visit TriRiversMSK.com. Tri Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
Welcome back. If you're joining us a little bit late, that's fine. Still lots to talk about on Book Talk today. Cheryl Ferreira is with us. Cheryl is on staff at the Mars Area Public Library, and the book we're discussing is Lincoln's Last Trial by Dan Abrams. Not really his last trial, but his last sensational trial, which he won, by the way.
Yes.
In fact, it was a four-day trial, but the jury only was out for 1 hour and 9 minutes.
I was surprised at that, too.
Yeah.
And as I read it, I wasn't so sure he was going to win. I thought the prosecution had a great case.
They had a great case. The prosecutor was John Palmer. And the names that pop up in this book are just amazing. I, of course, had never heard of John Palmer before. He later became governor of Illinois, and then later still a U.S. senator from Illinois. But he was the prosecutor facing Abraham Lincoln. There was another attorney, actually, Logan. I can't remember his first name off the top of my head. He had been, he and Lincoln had been partners at one point. He was an esteemed, much older lawyer, and he was on the team as well, but Abe kind of was the lead defense attorney in the whole thing. I found it fascinating to read about the way Lincoln behaved during a trial, how he was very quiet, studious, not a whole lot of histrionics. In fact, Abrams says at times he would stare at the ceiling, almost as if he were daydreaming. He was really listening very carefully because he had a photographic memory, but he did not react a whole lot while he was sitting there, while the prosecution was cross-examining witnesses. He did become animated, though, whenever he spoke to the jury.
You mean in closing statements?
Well, even during the, even while he was taking testimony or cross-examining a witness, he would turn to the jury every once in a while and point or, you know, chuckle. He used humor. He tried to, you know, convey this folksy image. Hey, I'm Abe. You know me.
Right.
I don't take a case unless I think the guy is innocent, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And continue that for the 4 days. And
he had a way of doing that without seeming like he was pandering to the jury. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't over the top in it, but it was so natural. I mean, Abrams often quotes, or not quotes, but says that consensus had it even with other trials, that he was just, you know, so good at what he did. Becoming the average person to the jurors, speaking in words that weren't too hard to understand. So he had a talent.
He had a, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase that Abrams used. Lincoln obviously was an intelligent man, and he could use more elegant language, but his theory was if he used folksy language, then everybody would understand.
Right.
And the people who are highly educated were going to understand anyway.
Right.
But if he used language that was too elegant, then the people who weren't well educated wouldn't get it. So,
right.
Interesting theory of the practice of law, which Abe Lincoln was very, very good at.
Very good. Yes. And but never did he not have the technical information to put out there, because I know he did the one steamboat case, and he really investigated what was going on and, mm-hmm. and was able to provide technical details. So
some of the little details were fascinating to me. Lincoln would carry his legal papers in his hat, in his top hat.
I thought they would be all rolled up. So
I
that,
thought so, too. Why did, I guess you had to roll them up and stick them in there. But he didn't have a briefcase or anything. When he needed to carry court papers, he put them in his hat.
Yeah, and that was another interesting thing about his dress, even, that he dressed very plain. And even though he had the money, he could have worn better suits. He had kind of an old suit and that top coat.
Yeah, one point was made. Sometimes he had this sweat-stained outer coat, top coat on. Suit coat, I guess you'd call a sports coat in today's terminology, and dusty shoes. Now, he could dress up, depending on what the what the trial was and so on and so forth, but he very often in Springfield would come dressed very casually. Kind of dirty, as a matter of fact. By the way, he didn't have a beard then. Did you know that? Yeah.
Well, the picture doesn't have the beard. I know.
Well, there's a story about that.
You know,
I meant to look it up so I had the exact details. But when he was running for president, there was a... he got a letter from a young girl. This is almost, you know, like, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, but it's a different story. And the young girl thought he'd look good in a beard. And he said, well, if I win the presidency, I'll grow a beard. And he did.
Wow.
So most of the pictures that we know, even the silhouettes of Lincoln, have the beard on our money, you know, on the Lincoln penny. He's got a beard. The Lincoln Memorial, that magnificent huge statue of him sitting in the chair. I can remember seeing that when I was a kid. My goodness, what a monstrous statue that was. He's got a beard.
Yep.
But he really only grew it after he was elected president. And, you know, unfortunately, he was killed very shortly after he was reelected. I mean, very, very shortly. So he really only served about 4 years as president.
Right.
4 years with a beard. But that's the way we always picture him in our mind's eye. We do picture him with the top hat, though. And he used that even when he was practicing law back in Springfield.
Yep, I didn't know it had served any other purpose besides keeping his head warm.
His briefcase. Yeah.
Yes.
We're talking about Lincoln's last trial, actually his last sensational trial. I also did not know that Lincoln had military service in the Black Hawk War. Had you ever heard of Black Hawk War?
I had not.
I had not either. In fact, in my notes, I put a big question mark beside it. to look it up, and I did. It was a rather brief skirmish with some Native American Indians. You want the details?
Sure.
April through August of 1832. Now, this murder trial is 1859, so we're going back quite a few years. It would have been a very young Abe Lincoln. A Black Hawk, who was a Sauk chief. I never heard of that tribe either.
No.
They were in the Iowa Territory, and he and his band crossed the Mississippi into the state of Illinois, and Illinois mobilized a frontier militia, and Abe Lincoln was part of that militia, and they went after Black Hawk. Lincoln never saw any combat. He was never in combat, but he was in this militia, so technically he had military service. There were a number of other participants in this militia who later became famous. Winfield Scott, Zachary Taylor, and of all people, Jefferson Davis.
Wow.
Who would be elected president of the Confederacy some 30 years later. Isn't that an amazing coincidence?
That is.
They were all in that
a small
Illinois
skirmish.
Militia, yeah. Lasted a few months. But anyway, that was the Black Hawk War. There were interesting stories about, and you mentioned this, Cheryl, how law was practiced back then. They were really still setting precedent. Now, keep in mind, folks, Lincoln was only the 16th president.
Right.
This is, 1860, give or take. And a lot of legal precedent was still being set. Much of the way a courtroom looked.
That was another funny thing.
Yeah. And it was based, just like today, it was based on the British court system that goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. The judge sat on a raised platform at the front of the courtroom, and then the attorneys were down in front of him. And then there was a low railing that separated the gallery, the public, the seats, the peanut gallery, from the front of the courtroom, a low railing called the bar.
The bar.
So, and I've heard that, attorneys pass their state certification these days and they're admitted to the bar. We have the Butler County Bar Association. That's where it comes from, but I never knew the derivation of that. Why did they call that low railing the bar? And this goes back to British law, British jurisprudence. It referred to a sandbar in the River Thames that when ships came up the Thames into London at high tide, once they crossed that bar, then the ships and the crew were subject to British law. Once they crossed that bar, that sandbar. I'd never heard that before.
Me neither.
I was familiar with the term, but I have no idea where it came from. Well, those are the kind of tidbits that you get every once in a while from Abrams. It makes the book a little lengthier. It's 300 pages.
Right.
With bibliography. But it flows pretty quickly. I found it to be a very easy read. I don't know about you.
I did, too. I enjoyed it. And the way he put in the facts weren't complicated, so it was easy. Like, I was afraid there would be a lot of legal jargon and mirrored in a lot of legal stuff that would be bog it down, but that really isn't the case. And a lot of what I thought was interesting is when each witness was called, there was always a paragraph about their character. Like, everybody knew everybody, and, they were upstanding, or they had been, a lot of people were related to connections of people in the case. So that, I like that aspect of learning about all the characters, even though they were just witnesses and brief characters in the whole book. It was interesting background.
Abrams does, however, give full details of every witness that was called, and we go through it step by step because we have the transcript.
Right.
Thanks to Robert Hitt. And so some of that gets pretty detailed. I suppose I could have cut that down a little bit. But
I was a little confused with all the details about the east and west counters in the actual drugstore and where everybody was standing. I kept, sometimes I was trying to draw it out to see where they were. I'm not good with spatial relations, so that was a bit of a challenge.
I think it would have been enough to say that Peachy was sitting there reading a newspaper and his, you know, Greek and his gang came in and beat him up. I mean, okay, that's
right.
Really all I need to know. I don't know the exact location of his stool in the drugstore.
It was a lot of detail on each and every step they took and whose hand was where, yeah.
By the way, I read this, I think it was, maybe it was in the last chapter. The owner of the drugstore, after Peachy was acquitted, of course, that was controversial for some. I mean, part of the general public in Springfield thought it was great that he was acquitted. Others thought that he got away with murder.
Right.
And they actually charged the owner of the drugstore as an accessory, claiming that his name was Short, I think. Eventually, the charges were dropped.
Okay.
But they charged him, claiming that he had, should have done more to stop the fight or something like that. These were the people who were upset whenever Peachy, I love that name.
I know.
Peachy was acquitted. There are also interesting stories that Dan Abrams pops in every once in a while about other cases that Abraham Lincoln was involved in. And Lincoln was, how would we say it? He had no specialty. He was, I guess, general practitioner, a lawyer. He did civil cases. He did criminal cases. If somebody had a border dispute or some story about two guys who had bought a plow and then refused to pay for it or something like that, a civil case, he handled that. And obviously, he handled a lot of murder trials. He handled like 25, 26, 27 murder trials in addition to this one.
Right.
Lincoln would ride the circuit in his early days as a lawyer. And this was another interesting thing that I didn't know about. Did you find that fascinating, too?
Well, I made a note, and I'm not sure if it was about the circuit, but they were end up in people's living rooms at times to have court. And that I'm thinking back, that was probably the descriptions of the circuit, I guess. And this was more frontier. Like, this wasn't the East Coast, which may have had more nicer courtrooms, or I'm not sure, but this just seemed kind of out there.
Yeah, many lawyers would be on horseback, and with a judge, they'd ride the circuit and pop into a town. They tried to do it twice a year, and then they'd, okay, what do we have on the docket here, you know, over the last 6 months? And they'd go through the cases as quickly as they could, trying to reach a settlement, maybe before trial. And then they'd get on their horses, and they'd go to the next area. Lincoln, of course, eventually settled down with his law office. I found it interesting, the description of his law office. Messy would be kind.
Yes.
To say that Lincoln's law office was messy. It was filthy.
Yes. I was surprised at that, too.
Dirty window panes you could hardly see out of. In fact, they were so dirty they hardly let the light in. In the front door, there were two broken windows. There was at one point where he and Robert Hitt left to go get something to eat, and he said, Lincoln didn't lock the door to his office. There was no need. There were two broken window panes in the door.
Right.
Anybody could have gotten in if they wanted to, but probably couldn't find anything. Lincoln actually, there's one quote that he said. He had a bunch of papers sitting on one corner of his desk tied up with a shoestring or something, and with a note on the top that said, if you can't find it anywhere, it's probably in here.
That's great.
Does that sound like Abe Lincoln? Not to me. Funny, funny. And there were some funny things in this book. There's no question about it. We'll take a break. We're talking about Lincoln's Last Trial. It's a new book, new this year, by Dan Abrams. And we're talking about it on Book Talk here on the It's Your Turn program today. I'll be back after these words.
You and your family are invited to attend the Thompson Miller 18th Annual Remembrances, Tinsels, and Tears Candlelight Memorial Service on Tuesday, December 4th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Mount Chestnut Presbyterian Church, 727 West Old Route 422 in nearby Mount Chestnut. Holiday time can be difficult, especially after experiencing the recent death of someone you love. We want to support you as you remember the life of your loved one during this holiday season. season. The Acts Choir will be joining us again this year, and there's no charge. Our special remembrance tree in memory of loved ones who have died is on display throughout December at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in downtown Butler. Please join us on Tuesday, December 4th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Mount Chestnut Presbyterian Church, 727 Old Route 422 in nearby Mount Chestnut. Easily handicap accessible. For information about purchasing a remembrance ornament in memory of your loved one, visit our website at www.thompson-miller.com. The name of your loved one will be recognized at the service. We look forward to seeing you there.
It's a Book Talk Day here on It's Your Turn on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Shel Ferrero is here. She's on staff at the Mars Area Public Library. And the book selected for discussion this month is Lincoln's Last Trial by Dan Abrams. Abrams throws in stories about several other trials that Lincoln had been involved in over the 20 years that he had practiced law. Do you remember any of those off the top of your head, Cheryl?
Well, one of the ones that a couple that I made notes about were, one established some municipal law. It was a case about a company was responsible for what their employees' actions were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a precursor to, negligence law, sorry. That the actions the negligence of a employee, the owners of whatever that employee was doing could be held responsible. That was one of the ones. And then the other one was the one with the steamboat.
Mm-hmm.
That I just wrote down that he actually went on a steamboat to learn the mechanics and some of the details of that to try the case.
He prepared himself meticulously for a case. On the other hand, there was one example, a story of Hannah Armstrong. Lincoln had known this woman. In fact, at one point, he had stayed with her family. Well, it turns out at some point later, her son, Duff Armstrong, age 24, was charged with murder after he had hit another guy in the eye with something called a slung shot. Not a slingshot, a slung shot, which was a leather thong that had a little piece of metal in it. The closest I could think of is like David and Goliath, you know. But anyway, he hit this guy in the eye, and somebody else had hit him over the head with a board. And the other guy was, his trial was first, and he was quickly convicted. And then Duff Armstrong was to go on trial, and Hannah asked Lincoln to defend him. And Lincoln meticulously went through one of the eyewitnesses who claimed that he had seen Duff Armstrong hit this guy with the slung shot in the eye, which, by the way, didn't seem to be that serious of an injury. But Lincoln led this guy on. So, how close were you? Well, it was 150 yards, whatever it was. And was there enough light to see? Oh, yes, it was a full moon. I could see very plainly. And once Lincoln got him to say that, Lincoln reaches over, pulls out his almanac, opens it up to the page he'd already marked, shoves it in the guy's face, and says, "Read that." And, of course, on the date of the incident,
right.
It was not a full moon. In fact, it was barely a quarter moon. There wasn't much light at all. And he had proven the guy, the prime witness, to be a liar.
Right.
Just like that. And Duff was acquitted. Acquitted of all charges.
Yes.
So that's the kind of, photographic memory,
meticulous
preparation that Lincoln had. He had the almanac already open to the right page. All he had to do was get the guy to say it. And then, wham, he gave it to him and said, "Go ahead, read that."
Right.
The guy knew he was done.
He was very patient during trials to accumulate the minute details that he needed to cross-examine. And, yes, very meticulous.
The only thing that we don't have, unfortunately, are the closing arguments for the two sides. And I was disappointed because there was so much detail on all the witnesses, all the testimony from 4 days of this trial were written down by Robert Hitt, but he did not take any notes during the closing arguments by either the prosecutor or Lincoln.
I had that written down, too, because the way it was described, it sounded like he wasn't supposed to or permitted to do the closing arguments, or it's just a choice he makes not to do the closing arguments. I couldn't figure out why not.
I guess. I don't know. But keep in mind that, you know, during regular court proceedings at this time, there was no stenographer anyway.
Right.
To take down anything.
Right.
Testimony or closing arguments or anything like that.
I thought it was interesting in the closing arguments that Lincoln asks if, or I guess at the end of the closing arguments before the jury goes to deliberate, he suggests that the jury here hits transcription of the earlier testimony. And at first, Palmer says, okay, but hold on, let me talk to my co-counsel. And then they change their mind and they don't want them to hear the... So I wasn't sure if that's something that nowadays, can the jury hear transcripts if they need to?
I think they can request. And again, trial laws differ from state to state.
Okay.
You know, in some states, you can televise a criminal trial.
Right.
O.J. Simpson, for example, in California. Pennsylvania, you can't. You're not even allowed to take... audio recording devices into a courtroom.
Okay.
So it differs from place to place. One interesting thing, and I don't have any training in the law, but I was familiar with the term hearsay, which is not allowed to be used as evidence, but that was a crucial part of this case.
Right.
Because there was a gentleman, happened to be the grandfather of Peachy Harrison, which kind of raised my eyebrows. But he purported to say that he had heard Greek Crofton on his deathbed say, it was all my fault. Don't hold Peachy Harrison responsible. I started it, and I'm sorry. He was the only guy that heard that.
Right.
And Lincoln was determined to find a way to get that into the testimony, even though it was obviously hearsay. So he worked on that, and eventually that was worked in, and that was one of the reasons why our good friend Peachy was acquitted. Acquitted of all charges, by the way.
Right.
He walked out of the courtroom after the jury came back.
Yep, I was surprised at that. Also, though, I was confused. He wasn't allowed to testify for himself. Peachy couldn't take the stand. And I wasn't sure if that was because of self-defense. There was this whole... And there was a lot of history in trying to figure out how the self-defense...
Well, sometimes attorneys will not have a defendant take the stand, but that's of their own free
right.
will, their own choice, you know. I don't recall the exact circumstances or whether they were even talked about in this book. We're talking about Lincoln's Last Trial, which was just a pretty darn good book. It goes back here and there, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which I think most people have heard about, when Abraham Lincoln was vying for the U.S. Senate. This would have been the year before this trial, so it was 1858. And I did not know this. Lincoln actually won the popular vote in that Senate election after the Lincoln-Douglas debates. There were seven of them, I think, altogether, seven debates. Lincoln won the popular vote, but at that time, state legislatures awarded Senate seats.
Right.
And Lincoln was running as a Whig. The Illinois state legislature was controlled by Democrats, and they awarded the Senate seat to Democrat Stephen Douglas, even though Lincoln had won the popular vote. We see that once in a while today, don't we?
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes.
Interesting parallel as well that Abrams makes, and this is kind of subtle, but the whole controversy that started this and eventually led to this murder and this murder trial, you know, it was a feud between two hot-headed young guys, and it just escalated and... Neither one of them really wanted to fight, but then it became a question of, well, we almost have to fight, you know, the lines were drawn in the sand. A parallel to the Civil War, really.
Right.
You know, which Lincoln, of course, would be heavily involved in. And it was only 1 year after this trial that he was nominated by the Republican Party to run for president and won, of course.
Right.
1860.
Exactly. You had mentioned earlier that there was some humor and a couple funny things, and I just wanted two things that I had written down. I was fascinated by Robert's hits, just the background of him and how that whole process came to be, and how he, you know, really tried. He always just wrote what people said, even though he was constantly accused of writing it favorably for one side or the other. But he, one of the things he said he was struggling with was if he couldn't catch a name, oftentimes witnesses would mumble and he wouldn't be able to. So he would have to leave that blank and then try to figure that out. But the other thing was when they used bad language, how was he to document? So he came up with writing the first letter and the last letter with dots in the middle of a bad word, which I thought was interesting.
Still used today.
Right. Yes. And lastly, it was very hot during the time of the trial, so they would take recesses now and then. But one day when the judge was getting ready for the trial and he was putting on his robes, he had nothing on underneath his robes. And he was saying, well, no one will know. Maybe this is how they do it in Scotland. He wasn't sure. It was just kind of a funny little added thing. Because this particular judge was pretty gruff. Like, he wasn't, I don't know how to describe it, as personable as some judges maybe they have alluded to in the past. Pretty by the book.
Yeah, and he wasn't a big fan of Lincoln. His name
right.
was Edward Rice, and he wasn't a big Lincoln supporter, which had Lincoln worried, of course. I found an interview from just a couple of weeks ago, believe it or not, with Dan Abrams. He made a guest appearance at Auburn University down in Alabama, talking about this book because, as we said, it's a brand new book released earlier this year. And it was interesting because just a couple of notes that I took here from this interview or this talk that he gave down at Auburn. He said, I think this is a side of Lincoln that many people have never seen. I would agree.
Yes.
I knew he was a lawyer, but I didn't know anything else about it. I didn't know he did murder cases. Lincoln's impassioned closing arguments sometimes would leave the jury half crying and half furious.
I could see that.
And that was the case in one particular trial where Revolutionary War widow's claim of pension theft. And Lincoln took that case, and by the time he finished his summation, half the jury was crying, and you know how that one went. Some other comments Dan Abrams made just a couple of weeks ago down at Auburn talking about this book. It's a bestseller, by the way.
Yes.
My copy comes from Prospect Library, I think that says.
There are several in the system. Yeah, that one is from Prospect.
Prospect. Obviously, you have one down at Mars, and there are several others. I would recommend this book to anybody,
Cheryl. I recommend it as well,
whether you're a Lincoln buff or a Civil War buff or a history buff.
Legal buff.
Yeah, I forgot about that. And it's not a hard read.
No.
It is 300 pages. You know, it's detailed, but it's pretty quiet. I read it in a couple of days without any trouble.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for picking this.
Thank you for having me and reading it.
I enjoyed it immensely. Let me give you this book back if you could.
I will return
it. Put it on the truck and get it back to where it belongs. Again, listeners, the author is Dan Abrams. That's the guy on TV, the ABC television legal analyst and the live PD guy. Abrams, A-B-R-A-M-S, if you're looking for it, Dan Abrams. And the title is Lincoln's Last Trial. Selecting that book and here to chat with us about it, Cheryl Ferrero. She's on staff at Mars Area Public Library. It's good to see you. I always enjoy talking about books with you, Cheryl.
Me as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Happy holidays.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas. It's all coming up pretty
coming.
Quickly. Yeah. More to come on It's Your Turn. We'll be back after this. It's the holiday season, and you're buying gifts for everyone, but not everyone lives around here anymore. So you've got to ship those gifts, and you want a local, reliable shipping company that you can trust to get that package to your loved ones. We suggest Going Postal in Butler. Going Postal, just off Newcastle Road. They'll find a way to ship just about anything. Simple, too. Just take the gift up. They pack it. They ship it. And if you want to get stocking stuffers like lottery tickets or Christmas cards, they've got those, too. They're just off Newcastle Road, right in between Villa Grande and King's Restaurant. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping store.
Welcome back to the It's Your Turn program. Tyler Friel in for Dave Malarkey, and a big thanks to the Mars Public Library for dissecting Lincoln's last trial, the murder case that propelled him to the presidency. And again, you can find that online, and we'll have more information for that with you. Part of Dave's Book Club, which you can find on WISR680.com. Coming up later on in the program, in actually just a few minutes, we'll be hooking up with Matthew Kramer. He is the maestro of the Butler County Symphony. We've got another symphony show on the way for you, and it's one of the more popular ones, as we will focus on the holiday season. It's the Holiday Traditions Show, and they encourage family to come and check things out. There will be music from I'll Be Home for Christmas, White Christmas, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Of course, we have kicked into a full-on holiday music. You may not be in the holiday music mode just yet because of the weather that we had earlier today, but don't worry, you'll be feeling it soon. We're supposed to even see some possible snow showers by tonight, so make sure you tune in to WISR all day long, as we'll take you through some of the holiday music. Of course, this is a part of the Symphony's 2018-2019 season. This will be their third show of the year. It started with Bernstein and Barber, Leonard Bernstein or Leonard Bernstein, not quite sure. I don't know if we've decided on what the pronunciation of that is yet. Of course, Dave probably would know that better than I would, but nonetheless, that was the opening show. And then we had the magical music of Harry Potter. That was a pretty cool one as well. And the Holiday Tradition Show is coming up this upcoming Saturday, along with the Butler County Home Tour, the Tour of Homes, and we'll be talking about that as well. So we've got a full half hour of symphony talk lined up for you, and again, that will be coming your way in just a matter of moments. Would like to, again, maybe perhaps you missed it this morning or throughout the afternoon, we do have the full list of our float winners on the website, butlerradio.com. But we've got our Spirit of Christmas Parade float winners. And a big thanks to, first of all the team that helped out to make this all possible, XTO Energy and People's Gas. They did a fantastic job. The skating rink, even though the weather may have been a little bit damp, there were still some kids out there who thoroughly enjoyed hitting the skating rink up. And, of course, our big Candyland, life-size Candyland at the Butler YMCA, and that was presented by XTO Energy as well. I know we had our hot cocoa warming station, and I know Pat Parker, the producer, was manning the hot cocoa station as well inside the city fire department. So big thanks to all the help that was there. We had our little plaza on Main Street. I know the Turkey Hill Cow ice cream was quite popular. And I know Small Business Saturday was quite popular as well. There were a lot of people hanging out downtown doing some Christmas shopping, getting some lunch. Restaurants like Natilly's, the Chop Shop were packed, as well as some of our local breweries downtown as well. So always nice to see a bunch of smiling faces on Main Street throughout the day. And, of course, the people that line Main Street during the nighttime as well for Butler County's only nighttime parade, at least downtown Butler's only nighttime parade. And so we were really happy to help bring that on. And actually, now you can go see the video of the broadcast of the parade now online at butlerradio.com. Thanks to our friends at Armstrong. They did a terrific job, as always. And so you can check out that full video with our own Tracy Morgan and Kayla Molzan on the call. They kind of look like football broadcasters if you watch it. They're calling it from up top of Miller's Shoes, actually. And that's where they did the broadcast from. So it kind of feels like Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth are getting ready to call the action. They've got their headsets on, and some pretty cool stuff right there. Anyways, the winners of the floats for the parade, we'll start in the nonprofit category first. This was the best overall winner, and that goes to North Street Christian Church. And our most original winner in the nonprofit category was Caprine Connection, and for the best use of lights, Graceway Community Church. For the commercial category, the best overall was pretty neat.
People's Gas. And again, the theme of our parade this year was Christmas, hometown Christmas, past, present, and future. And People's decided to go to the past, and they had a bunch of former businesses and some current businesses that used to be in downtown Butler, places like Allen's Toy Shop, Cummings Coffee, the Hot Dog Shop, Worsley's. They had it all designed on the back of the float. It looked absolutely fantastic. Very cool design from People's Gas. The most original was Clear Choice Enterprises, and the best use of lights was actually a tie between Team Hardinger and AK Steel. As for the best overall in the open category, congrats to Miss Military Star for winning our best overall in the open category. And again, a big thanks to our team, especially here, Megan Willison, who coordinates the parade, our parade team, Sharon Schneider, Jimmy Chiprian, Jim Thompson, Vicky Hanneberger, all doing a fantastic job of making this all possible. And of course, the staff at the Butler Radio Network for all that they did. I personally was not there. I was out on the road alongside our sports director, Bob Cupp, as we went to Connecticut to go watch the Slippery Rock University football squad take on the New Haven Chargers, and they came away with a win. You can hear actually next week's broadcast on 97.7 FM. They are now in the national quarterfinals. They're a team that's doing pretty well. So it was pretty cool to have an opportunity to travel up to New Haven. Actually, New Haven home to Yale University, and so Yale plays in New Haven. Meanwhile, New Haven plays in West Haven. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's how it works. So whatever, we went up to the Northeast, and we had a darn good time. And there's some pretty cool houses in Connecticut, if you really want. We got detoured into this really ritzy neighborhood. I'm like, holy cow, we must have traveled into the money. I don't know if we should have been there, but we were there nonetheless. So pretty cool weekend in Connecticut, and a big thanks to all that listened. If you are a Slippery Rock football fan, thanks to all who listened to that broadcast. And again, you can catch that next week. They traveled to Notre Dame College. No, not the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, but rather the Notre Dame in Euclid, Ohio. It's just outside of Cleveland. And again, that's a part of the national quarterfinals. It is a noon kickoff. It was just announced. And so you can hear that on our sister station, 97.7 Bob Cupp, and it will be Glenn Thompson this weekend on the call. All right. Well, let's move on to our next guest, and that will be Butler County Symphony Maestro Matthew Kramer. He's coming up after the break. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR 680 AM.
Olivia from Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that mommy and daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger, from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel, from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna, from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha, from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the It's Your Turn program, listeners. I'm Tyler Frio, in for Dave Malarkey. We're heading out to the phone lines for our, what really turns out, with the conductor of the Butler County Symphony and musical director, Matthew Kramer. Matthew, thank you for joining us. Happy post-Thanksgiving and happy pre-Christmas to you as well.
It's the perfect time of year, isn't it? They never want to talk about the holidays too soon before Christmas, but now we're up and running. Every musician in this country seems to be full calendar now until Christmas with concerts to perform.
Well, that's it. I mean, here we're getting ready for the holiday season, and I think we, once you get past Thanksgiving, I must feel like it's legal to start to play Christmas music, and the symphony must feel the same way. It is your annual holiday tradition show, and this is a pretty fun one because a lot of these tunes are ones that I would say we're quite familiar with.
That's absolutely right, and you hit on it. The balance for me every year is trying to fill this program with the classic carols that everybody expects and wants to hear this time of year, but also to mix things up and introduce new arrangements, bring in some new guest artists, and maybe a few things that people haven't heard. And it really is, like you mentioned, our title, Holiday Traditions. It's really our most popular program of the year, packed house every single year, and we think it's become truly a Butler tradition to spend a little bit of the holiday season with the beautiful music of Butler's Orchestra.
Well, let's start with some old-timey favorites, maybe Christmas tunes that the audience could expect to hear, and some of the ideas that go into incorporating those, or maybe some new twists that you have on some of them.
Sure. Well, last year, for example, we focused on music that came from childhood classic films, The Grinch, for example, Howard Blake's The Snowman, Charlie Brown Christmas. This year, we've given a nod to several classic holiday tunes that actually originated on the Broadway stage. It's fascinating to take a look at some of the favorite carols that we have that actually originated on Broadway. We Need a Little Christmas, for example, came from Maine, 1966. We also have It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, Meredith Wilson. It's actually, the song is called Pine Cones and Holly Berries, and that originated from a musical in 1963 called Here's Love. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, of course, everybody recognizes from Meet Me in St. Louis. Julie Garland made that one famous. And a couple other movie nods, too. White Christmas, the Irving Berlin classic by Bing Crosby, sung at Holiday Inn. And we've also got God Bless Us Everyone that was featured in the 2009 remake of A Christmas Carol. So these are all songs that we hear on the radio regularly this time of year. But the origins aren't always known to most audience members where these songs originated from. So we've got two stellar singers who are going to be joining us, Butler's own Kelly and Michael Mara, two wonderful performers who will join us on stage, along with high school singers from Butler High School and Seneca Valley High School as well. So we've got a lot of voices, at the center of this program.
And I think when you see, hear some of those Christmas classics, there's always a little bit of a different take on them. And maybe it's just very, very small. Do you have to work with the vocalist when you're working on the arrangement, or is it pretty much the same the whole way across the board?
Well, you hit on it again. You've got so many different arrangements to choose from. And any time that you work with a singer, you have to be sure that the keys work out. Everybody has their own voice range. There are only certain arrangements available, but there are multiple arrangements of many of these selections. And so all of these that originated on the musical stage were performing in their original form. And again, it seems like every popular artist on the radio has covered on a Christmas album some of these tunes at some time, at one point or another. So there are multiple arrangements. You want to make sure that the singers are comfortable. They know where the introduction is. They know where the bridge is. And that they, that's also why we have rehearsal to go through all of this too. The young singers from Butler and Seneca have had their music for about a month now, and we all put this together in really two very short rehearsals, but so many of these arrangements have been in front of the orchestra and the musicians for many years. A couple other staples worth mentioning here are the Polar Express, which is popular every time of year. I have a six-year-old who likes to watch it in the summertime, actually really every season except for Christmas, it seems. The Christmas Song, the Mel Torme classic, and Carol of the Bells, which was made so famous really by the Trans-Siberia Orchestra. How can you compete with that, like Flames and electric guitars? And I think we'll have a rather tame one in comparison, but still so classic musicals here.
We're talking with Matthew Kramer. He's the musical director for the Butler County Symphony. Their upcoming holiday tradition show is this Saturday. I like to hear a choir's take on a lot of these holiday songs. I think when you listen to them on the radio, you really get just maybe one vocalist or perhaps a duet going back and forth with some of these holiday tunes. But every once in a while, when you actually sit down and you get to hear a choir and all the different voices that are going on with some of these musical performances, I really do think it breathes a different type of new life into some of these holiday tunes.
I agree with you completely, especially with the harmonies, because with one singer, you might have a backup group. But I find, and I'm completely biased in this, obviously, as a classical musician and enjoy jazz and Broadway, but so much of the music that you hear now is auto-tuned and highly manufactured in the studio by producers, that when you hear a chorus singing really rich harmony, in traditional forms, really, not so much of the pop and rock kind of setting in these songs, you get to, I think, really experience how they were conceived by the composers, that wrote them, and their simplicity in some cases, but it's really the richness so much that makes these arrangements work. And also the setting, too. You know, we perform Beethoven, we perform Bernstein, and those are the concerts where our audience members are really, you know, very quiet, listening attentively. But these kinds of these family programs, if you will, or the popular programs, we encourage people to hum along. And so really everybody is involved. In fact, at the end of the program, it's such a tradition for us to have a Christmas carol sing-along. The insert, the words are in the program. If most people are like me and can only ever remember the first verse of anything, well, we've got the words right there so they can sing along with us. And that's the great sense out of this, is that we always end with Sleigh Ride. The audience kind of gets up and greets one another. And there's a real communal feeling here that I think really does help kickstart the holiday season for so many of us.
We're talking with Matthew Kramer. He is the musical director for the Butler County Symphony. Michael and Kelly Mara will be a vocalist performing. What have you heard from them? What can the audience expect to hear from them?
Well, if anyone attended our program last December, they heard Michael Mara, who, again, grew up in Butler and went off and made a very fine career, has returned to Butler now and is still performing regularly. He was our Grinch last year and did a wonderful Burl Ives impersonation, as well as reading, no, not Burl Ives, excuse me, a wonderful, I'll think of his name. He was, of course, the Dracula in, it'll come to me in a second, but the voice of the Grinch, so famous. And Michael did a great, great rendition of it. And of course, he read the Dr. Seuss classic as well. So he's coming back and bringing his Broadway roots with his wife, which is spectacular. And the two of them will perform several lovely duets, as I mentioned already, White Christmas, O Holy Night. They'll be joining along with the chorus as well for that, beginning to look a lot like Christmas. And then this wonderful song from a musical called She Loves Me. It's called The 12 Days to Christmas, and it's about two employees at a merchandise shop. Every day they get closer to Christmas, it becomes more chaotic. So in this song, 12 Days to Christmas, it starts off very fun and bright, and then it just ends hysterically with these two people panicking. So we've really, I think, in this year's program, been able to mix a lot of the classic carols that everybody wants to hear, and I'm sure there'll be at least four or five selections here that no one's had any familiarity with, but will walk away very delighted.
Was it Boris Karloff? Was that the original voice of the
you
Grinch?
You got it. Thank you, Tyler. It would have driven me crazy. Boris Karloff. That's absolutely right. The original Grinch. I don't know how I could forget it, but now he's been incarnated by every Jim Carrey, and now there's a new one coming out. It's hard to keep track. You've got it. Thank you.
I think Benedict Cumberbatch is the new Grinch, at least if my Google search engine is telling me the correct information. We're talking with Matthew Kramer. He's on the line, musical director of the Butler County Symphony. Is there an instrument or maybe instruments that when you hear, you connect to the holiday season?
Sleigh bells. You can put sleigh bells to anything, and it makes it Christmas immediately. I'm thinking, for example, Gustav Mahler's Fourth Symphony, a very serious work, about an hour long, starts with the sound of sleigh bells. And so whenever anybody hears it, they think Christmas. So that's an instrument that, of course, is in Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride. Mozart used it, actually, and several composers have written Sleigh Rides. So it's that one percussion instrument, I think, more than any other instrument that is really indicative of the sound of Christmas. Of course, the celesta is featured so prominently in Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. There are several instruments, I think, that have a holiday sound, but no more, no greater than that sound of that percussion instrument, the sleigh bells.
Now, do you have a favorite composition for the holiday season that no matter whenever December comes flips over on the calendar, you're like, oh, you know what, I got to put this on at least one time this year?
Oh, it's always Sleigh Ride, first and foremost. I think that's the one that we've always used it as an unprinted encore in our program book. Our audience just knows to expect it. And, of course, the Christmas Carol sing-along, just to get the audience involved with that. We're on a rotation of about 2 to 3 years, I think, with some of these great classics. We use the John Williams score for Home Alone at least every other year because it's so popular and just, you know, we do want to mix it up, so we try to rotate. There's one on this year's program that I try to alternate every two or 3 years, and it's actually Dmitri Tiomkin's suite from It's a Wonderful Life. Now, that movie is on every hour from now until Christmas on some channel on TV, it seems. It just runs continuously. And, of course, Jimmy Stewart classic. Everybody wants to see that around Christmas. But you stop and listen to the music. That was a very famous Hollywood composer, Dmitri Tiomkin, who wrote that score. He wrote scores for Westerns like High Noon as well. And you don't always recognize the score. It's very beautiful. And there is a title track actually called It's a Wonderful Life, the theme, that actually was cut from the movie and never used. So most people are completely unaware of it. I think it's absolutely worth the attention it should have deserved. And so we program that every 2 or 3 years, and Kelly Morrow will be singing that selection. So great suite. And again, there's so many different things to come back to every few years, but we always try to make the program different every year in some way, so people have they walk away with a different impression of it, but still great music, all of it.
You know, I've never seen Home Alone, the complete film. I feel like I should have.
You know, I grew up with it, and I can share this with you, Tyler. This is a joke I always tell to the audience, that when I was young, I thought it was great. Parents left you behind, and you're at home. Now I just realize, as a father, that's horrible parenting. I mean, it really is the whole basis for that movie. They neglected their child. Funny, though, Macaulay Culkin, a child star, right?
No, I know. And then they made a second one, and don't they leave him behind in the second one?
Yeah, the same parents with the same child. Like, that's years of therapy right there,
yeah, that's,
I think.
That's,
but, of course, in the 80s, that was just fun. I mean, that was obviously, as a child watching that, I thought it was great. And there was a third one where they replaced Macaulay Culkin because he got too old, and I think that one got a 9% on Rotten Tomatoes or something. So
you're saying don't watch the trilogy, maybe just the first two.
It's the third one is usually not as good as the first two.
Matthew Kramer, he's the musical director of the Butler County Symphony. Any final words that you'd like to get into the audience before the show this upcoming Saturday?
You can get your tickets now. I wouldn't wait. This always sells so well. Come spend a little bit of the holiday season with your Butler County Symphony. Some great holiday Christmas selections. We look forward to welcoming the whole community, young and old, into our audience.
He's Matthew Kramer, musical director of the Butler County Symphony. Matthew, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate it.
And we will jump over and talk the tour of homes coming up after the break. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR 680 AM.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 0606. The pick 3 is 667, 667. Pick 4, 4575. Pick 5, 31211. The wild ball is 2. And the treasure hunt, 7, 12, 14, 26, and 28. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Big thanks to Matthew Kramer, Butler County Symphony, and getting ready for the big holiday tradition show, sure to be a good time. That is coming up Saturday evening, December 1st, and that begins at 7:30. But during the day, if you're looking to spend the day with the symphony, it is the Holiday Tour of Homes. It is the 29th annual edition of the Tour of Homes, and with that, we bring in Sue Morrow, Shaylin Kirchie-Lang, both with the Butler County Symphony. Sue, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure a little bit of busy right now planning for the Tour of Homes.
It always gets really crazy the last week,
yeah.
Making sure that all the ends are wrapped up nice and neat and nobody's left out. And there, something always happens, you know. Mm-hmm.
Shaylin Kirchie-Lang, also one of our media consultants here at the Butler Radio Network. Is this your first year being a part of the Tour of Homes, or have you done this before?
I have done this before.
Okay.
Yes, so I'm a little bit of a veteran, but I Sue has been doing this forever. I'm learning the ropes.
And I think this is a really cool promotion. So maybe, Sue, if you could kind of generally lay it out for some of our listeners here, what exactly is a Holiday Tour of Homes, and what could people expect if they purchase a ticket for it?
every year we look for Butler County residents who are willing to open up their homes, decorate them for Christmas, and then allow a horde of people to tromp through them, checking them out. And we have folks who go on the tour every year who've gone since it started, and we always, of course, have new people who have never even heard of it who go, oh, that sounds like fun. Let me, you know, I think I'll go. But they go for many reasons. Some people go because maybe we're featuring a house that is just architecturally phenomenal,
yeah,
or very different. Or there are also the group of folks who go and they just like to look at decorations. They like to see how somebody else takes a nativity set and makes it their own and figures out a way to display it. So then they get ideas and they can go home and say, okay, now I know I want to take this from one house and this from another house and put it together and make my own arrangements. And then there are folks who go because they like to support the symphony. And this is one of our major fundraisers. As you mentioned, it is the 29th year. And we do have a couple houses this year that are repeat houses. And it's, you know, someone always says, well, why, you know, if they've already been on the tour, why are you having them again? It's because they're so exemplary and they're just mm-hmm. great homes. And the homeowners said, hey, you know what? I want to do the tour again. And so we go, okay, you know, maybe wait a couple years before, you know, don't come right back and do it the mm-hmm. next year. But, for example, we do have a home that's a little distance out on 38 in the Hooker area that some people did not get to see when we had it on the tour before, who said, are you going to put that house back on? Because I really want to go see that house. And I did just talk to one of the owners yesterday, and he is up over 75 decorated Christmas trees of one form or another. In the house.
Holy cow.
Inside. So
that's reason enough right there to buy a ticket and go on the tour to see how you can fit 75 trees in one home.
And they're all different. I mean, that's not necessarily saying 75 live Christmas trees or something like that. I mean, they're... And the last time I know I hosted out at their home when they were on before, and I invited people to try and count them. You know, can you get to
75?
Can you find them all? Well, then it was only 50.
So he's found room for 25 more.
He has really bumped up his game. Well, they have added some additions to the house and some have done some additional remodeling. So that was one reason they wanted to offer. We also have Millie and Dale Pinkerton, who are longtime Butler residents and very active and supportive in the Butler community. Their home is on again, and they just have a whole collection of years and years and years of wonderful decorations and things with a lot of memory and stories to tell. And so it had been a while since they'd been on, and I think Millie thought this was the year mm-hmm. to offer her home. We have a new member, a new, relatively new person to Western Pennsylvania even.
Okay.
Her husband is from over by Ford City, Cadogan, mm-hmm. that area. But she is not. And where she was before was in California, and she did garden tours out there, and so she decided that she called us. I mean, we didn't even recruit her, she called us. And her house is very classical Christmas. She's got a Victorian room, and it's beautiful. She kind of does some different themes. We also have a home that is just north of Butler, off of Route 8, behind where Bon Air School used to be, if you're familiar with mm-hmm. the area. And their home is snuggled in this nice, really pretty wooded area. And she has one room that she does it with gingerbread theme. And I said, oh, well, that's perfect. You know, as long as there's no witch there, you know, I don't want to scare anybody off. But that and some wintry scenes, and I have not seen her house decorated yet, so I'm really excited to get out there to see her home And let's see. We have one additional house on McCain Street.
Okay.
Beautiful, huge home. And they've been, you know, it was one of those, the wife kind of thought it might be a good idea to spur her husband to get him to do some much-needed home fixings and repairs. And so, you know, I'm sure he's probably saying, oh, I can't wait till this year is over. But I know that that house is going to be equally amazing.
So what are we looking at, about five homes you could possibly tour then?
We do have five homes this year. And we also, this year seems to be an interesting year. There have been several churches in Butler County who are celebrating their 175th anniversary or another major anniversary. For whatever reason, apparently when people were settling in this area, that, you know, churches began about the same time. So we do have First English Lutheran Church, which is right on the corner of Main Street and Brady Street. That is where we will have a luncheon that is an additional cost. It's separate from the house tour, so you could actually not go on the tour but go out for lunch if you choose.
Okay.
And we do have a group of, I was contacted about a group that wanted to do that. I said, sure, that's great, come. She said, we want to support the symphony, but we're older, maybe can't do the tour, whatever. Well, in addition to hosting the luncheon, First English is opening their sanctuary, which will be decorated. And we have two magnificent wall hangings that have been made by parishioners. One is for the 500 year of Lutheranism from the Reformation, and the other one is for our 175th anniversary of the church itself. So, in essence, we have five houses and a church sanctuary.
And I think it's so cool to go to another church because I think we all get accustomed, whatever religion you may be, you get accustomed going to the same place and it looks the same way. You know, if you're like me, it's been that way for your whole life. And then you go in to see some of these really cool architectural designs that people 100, 200 years ago had in mind. And it looks so different and so unique. Like, I've never been inside the First English Lutheran Church. And so maybe there are people out there like me that would go, okay, I'll go to the house tour and then I'll stop and get lunch at a church I've never been to before, because you can kind of get a cool different idea of some different architecture and different looks like that.
In addition, the church within the last year has put in a carillon, which if you're on Main Street, three times a day you hear it.
Okay.
Play music. Well, that particular day it will be set up to play on the hour from 10 to 3. So it'll play at least one seasonal hymn. Generally, we don't schedule Christmas hymns to play before Advent has even started, and Advent doesn't start till the next day. Mm-hmm. But
make an exception.
We will make an exception because that's a really unique experience to hear the bells.
Yeah. And again, we're here with Sue Morrow, Shaylin Kirchy-Lang. We're talking about the Butler County Symphony Association Holiday Tour of Homes. Shaylin, where can people get tickets, and what time is this going to be running?
Well, you can get tickets at a variety of locations. For sure, you can get them at the Butler County Symphony office. You can also pick them up at the Meridian Gift Shop and Mays Music Shop, and then Clyde Saloon in Cadogan. So if you're from that area, you want to support the Cadogan mm-hmm. family, you can just stop in your local neighborhood. The luncheon is on from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., so if you want to stop in and get lunch. And also during the luncheon, we have our holiday basket raffle on display. It's, again, on display at the concert, and we pull the winners that night. But you'll have an opportunity. You know, maybe you can't make it to the show. You could still buy some raffle tickets in the morning. And the tour of homes is all day long. It's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. $20 for the tickets if you get them before Saturday. The day of, they go up to $25.
And where can you get them the day of?
You can still get them
at all the locations?
Yes, but, well, not the symphony office. The symphony office
closed.
Is closed, but we will sell tickets at the church.
Okay.
So if you just go down to First English Lutheran, Mays is only open till 2 o'clock on that Saturday. Of course, that's kind of late in the day anyway if you want to buy a ticket. and Meridian Station, they will be open.
Okay.
I don't know about Clyde's.
Okay.
But
I don't know about Clyde's either.
So
but
let's just say if you're thinking about going, get them before Saturday because that way then you have an opportunity to go straight to the home, correct?
Correct. Yes. Actually, we also sell tickets at the homes.
Oh, okay, cool.
On a limited basis. Like we don't have a ton of tickets at every home, but if somebody would come to a home and start there, they can buy a ticket there. But again, it is $5 more. Mm-hmm. Which is more money for us, but less for you. So,
well, you at least want to keep that $5 because you want to go to the Holiday Tradition show later that night or get that $5 for basket raffle tickets. So an opportunity to see some really neat homes. Has there been a few that have stuck out during your time that you're like, wow, this was a really neat home? Or are they all different and unique in their own way?
They're different and unique. I mean, we've had a couple on that have just... because of the style of the home, they are different. We've had one gentleman 1 year does his business is woodworking.
Okay.
So his house, of course, was full of the things that he creates. Mm-hmm. We've had log homes. We've had Victorian homes. We've had modern homes.